Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the Hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. Health-quest.org for locations.
Hello once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. James Anania is an anesthesiologist with Nathan Latour Hospital. He's here with us today to discuss the latest advancements in anesthesiology and pain management and what you should tell your anesthesiologist before a medical procedure that requires general or local anesthesia. Dr. Anania earned his medical degree from Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York, one of the top in the country, and completed his residency at Yale. New Haven Hospital in New Haven, Connecticut. He's a board-certified anesthesiologist, and in his spare time, he volunteers with Smile Train and Research International, two NGOs that provide life-changing surgeries to poor people with deformities in third-world countries. Dr. Anania, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Good afternoon.
Hey, to part of today's conversation, everybody, and the phones are already lighting up. Give us a call at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, then there's no waiting. Okay, so I'm ready for you. Doctor, very quickly, we have some people on the phone. I just want to ask you one question.
Yes.
What do you have to tell your anesthesiologist?
Well, a patient will come in and be seen as a pre-op for surgery and be interviewed by an anesthesia provider. And usually we will focus on their health history and medications that they're on. We tend to ask questions mostly about the heart and the lungs and history of smoking, sleep apnea, prior surgeries, any complications with anesthesia in the past, and things like that. We also like to be told if you take any sort of drugs recreationally. That's a very important question.
Well, would you keep people secret if they told you they were using cocaine?
Well, it's a HIPAA. It would be a HIPAA violation. I mean, it's whatever is told to us is kept in privacy, but it will be documented down on the chart, obviously.
Right.
But the chart is a private. Will be kept private.
Well, and of course now we're moving to this business where everybody is going to be online, so that you can look up any patient, right? Sooner or later, we're going to all have this. So that's an interesting issue, an ethical issue, a medical ethics issue, don't you think?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. All right. Joanna, you're on 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead.
Thank you, doctor. I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Recently, my spouse, a few months ago, had a total hip replacement, and she had a nerve block catheter installed. And I think your audience would be interested in hearing about that. But I do have a question, which is she continued to have quite high pain levels, and it wasn't until about 12 hours after the surgery that a pain team came in and used a little cold pack on her hip and found out that the nerve catheter had totally failed, mm-hmm. wasn't providing any relief.
Okay.
Now, this is not a liability issue. We're not interested in suing. But I do wonder, in terms of a protocol, is there a step where that nerve block catheter is supposed to be tested in some way so that after surgery the people know sooner that nerve block catheter is not doing what it's supposed
okay,
to.
So Joanna, the first thing we're going to ask the doctor to do is to tell us about what this thing is and then tell us what kind of test.
Excellent.
Okay, this was a hip replacement, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so usually the hip replacements will be done under, we have a choice of either doing it under a spinal or under a general anesthetic. This patient had it done under a spinal, I take, is that correct?
No, it actually was general anesthetic
with
the nerve block.
Okay,
yep.
So what they probably did was offered the patient an epidural for post-op pain relief and received general anesthetic for the surgery. Post-operatively, the catheter that was left in the epidural space, now that's the epidural space, not in the spinal space where there is the cerebral spinal fluid. This catheter then will receive a continuous infusion of a local anesthetic narcotic mixture at a certain rate. Now, usually the catheters are tested when they're inserted. And it may have been functioning when it was inserted, and the test may have been positive. But what could possibly have happened is during the movement of the patient, and by the time they got onto the floor, it actually could have been displaced. That is one of the risks of a catheter being in place, is that it can dislodge and fall out, at which point you can just redo the procedure. That really is not...
the catheter procedure.
Correct,
yeah.
Yes.
But Joanna, you would know, wouldn't you, if it had fallen out?
Well, she did not have an epidural. I know that. Mm-hmm. It was general anesthesia, and the catheter was put into her groin area.
Okay, I have to ask.
Okay, now.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so if it was put into the groin area, then that would be called a femoral nerve block.
Okay.
And that was placed in the groin next to the nerve bundle, nerve artery blood vessel bundle. That catheter is placed there, and that's usually good for postoperative pain relief, and we use those mostly for knee surgeries. Now, the thing with us with regional, sometimes with these postoperative pain blocks, you do not get 100% pain relief, so you will have to supplement that with IV morphine through a patient-controlled analgesia pump. Postoperatively, the patient may have thought it might not be working, but actually may have been. I can't really say for sure. And if it was completely non-functioning, maybe the pain would have been more. But these blocks do not necessarily remove complete pain. So that could have been the issue also.
Interesting.
Well, thank you so much.
And thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Okay, well, these lines are all lighting up. Go figure. Let's go to Al in Clifton Park. Okay, Al in Clifton Park, you are on.
Oh, hello, Alan. Hello, doctor.
Oh, hello.
Hi. I have a question relating to some unexpected surgery I had recently to repair. It turns out it was to repair a removal of a basal cell carcinoma infiltrating in my face. And I had to undergo anesthesia 3 times in 2 days. And I noticed after the 3rd time that I was experiencing images, but my eyes were closed. I looked this up later on, and I found the term closed eye visualizations. And I'm wondering if that could be the result of anesthesia.
Very interesting question. When you receive a general anesthetic, and especially when you receive several in a row during that short period of time, your body does get loaded up with these drugs, and they can result in hallucinations. And as you said, you had 2 surgeries within a couple days. Was that correct?
3 surgeries
within a couple days. So really, when we do a procedure and we give a general anesthetic, we usually tell the patient not to do anything of significance for the first 24 hours, not to sign any documents, not to drive, not to operate any machinery for that reason, because drugs may be still circulating within your body. Now, you had 3 procedures within 2 days. There is a good chance that you had significant amount of drugs still circulating in your body causing these hallucinations. I mean, as long as they're resolved, that's basically what the issue was.
We've got to get over a break, which will only take a couple of seconds. But before we go, you just raised something that's very interesting. If you don't obey the doctors and you drive an automobile and you get into a crash, you're legally liable, aren't you?
Well, we try to enforce the issue that a patient has to have a driver on the day of surgery.
No, coming back. But they always tell you, you know, when I have this procedure, that they always say you can't drive for 24 hours. I always stay over because I'm a good boy.
Correct.
But in fact, if I got on the highway and I got into a crash, I could be in some trouble, like driving under the influence, couldn't I?
Correct. Yes, yeah. You will be driving under the influence, especially if you have painkillers on in your blood system.
Hey, Al, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Listen, we're having a good time. Just make your call now.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group, gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology, with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. PremierMedicalHV.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Mount St. Mary College in Newburgh, offering bachelor's and master's degree programs in education with dual certification in special education. MSMC.edu. And The Alternative Baker, Rosendale. Small batch, all butter, handmade baked goods, plus egg sandwiches, vegan soups, and hot chocolate. LemonCakes.com.
Deep Purple. I like Deep Purple. 1-800-348-2551. My friend from out where you are, I'm having surgery soon, and I know I will be asked about sleep apnea. I live alone. What should I do? I don't know if I have sleep apnea. That's what my friend Cheryl's saying. What do you think?
Okay. Well, if you have a history of sleep apnea, then...
And you have a CPAP machine. That's easy. Then you know you got it.
Correct.
What if you don't know?
Well, a lot of patients don't know. So when we interview a patient for a preoperative visit, we will ask them, do you have sleep apnea? A lot of patients may not know what that is.
Right. They didn't go to sleep clinic.
Unless you're studied in a sleep clinic. Well, the question will then proceed and we'll say, well,
do you snore?
Do you snore? Are you a very big snorer where, you know, you keep your spouse awake or you can be heard through the wall?
Yeah.
Do you wake up and frequently at night? Because what will happen is the patient will obstruct and they'll be apneic and they'll become hypoxic for a period of time and that'll wake them up.
Okay.
So that's basically just a lack of oxygen. So the person will wake up frequently at night. So that results in being sleepy during the day. And so that's a pretty good indication that you have sleep apnea.
Gotcha. Okay, that answers her question. Let's go to Calvin in Woodstock. Calvin, you're on.
Hello, thank you. Over the years, I've had a number of surgeries. Hernia surgery, three hand surgeries, double total knee replacements, after which I noticed a decrease in my energy levels, and I ended up being diagnosed with atrial flutter, for which I then had a heart ablation surgery. A couple questions. Is it possible that all of the anesthesia could have, even though I didn't show to have atrial flutter before surgery or after, that may have been exasperated, in any case, increased.
Made worse.
And the other is, what then might be the long-term effects of anesthesia, especially numerous ones? Can one expect memory loss or anything else that you might think of or share with us? I'd appreciate it.
Side effects,
correct. As far as the atrial flutter goes, that wasn't caused by the anesthesia per se. That's usually a intrinsic cardiac disorder that you probably have developed and resulting in that atrial flutter. As far as long-term side effects of anesthesia, there really isn't any. If, say, you were involved in a motor vehicle accident and you happened to be in the intensive care unit for 2 months and you were on intravenous drugs for pain and this and that, with time you will develop tolerance to these drugs. But if you have a surgery this week and then a couple of months you have another surgery, those really don't add up. It doesn't add up to any long-term side effects. It's only if you were to undergo several multiple days of intravenous treatment for that, such things. So no, the answer would be no. No side effects in long term just because you've had multiple surgeries.
Calvin?
As you said earlier, there may be hallucinations and things like that if you've had quite a bit.
Correct.
For several days, but you're saying there's really nothing that can occur in the long term where you've...
No, not if you've just...
Memory loss or anything like
that.
No,
not if you've had multiple surgeries over a period of time. I mean, that's pretty much that's going to become the norm of the population as it gets older and older.
Is there a period... Yes, right. Is there a period of time when you might feel diminished in your thinking? I mean, like months or so afterwards?
Just the stress of the surgery and the effects of the anesthetic drugs will drain you physically and mentally for a couple days afterwards. And the older and the sicker a patient is, the worse those symptoms will be. So it's really dependent on each patient.
Okay.
Well, good luck,
Calvin.
Thank you
very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to James in Saratoga Springs. James, your turn.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It's very similar, frankly, to the last call. I'm 63 years old, and I've had 13 medical procedures. And the last one, I noticed that the physicians and the anesthesiologists were kind of looking at each other. And my question was long-term effects for 13 procedures.
Interesting that you asked that question. 13 procedures is a lot, but nowadays, as a patient ages, they start to get more and more procedures done as more techniques are devised and more things can be operated on. So when they looked at
things go wrong.
As when they looked at each other, in all honesty, they probably just looked at each other with of interest of thinking, wow, 13 surgeries. I mean, that's about it. I mean, it's not like you can have a certain amount of limited numbers of anesthetics through your lifetime. I mean, you could pretty much have anesthesia every time you need surgery. The drugs we use now are actually very clean. And when I mean clean, they have very minimal side effects. The drugs we use are very quick acting and very quick to dissipate from the body. That's because that's the trend, is going from inpatient surgery to a majority of outpatient surgery, which means the patients will be operated on and discharged within an hour or two after surgery.
Right.
And that tends to be the majority of the procedures now. So the drugs we use now, we wouldn't have been able to do this if we were using some of the drugs we had in the past, like pentothal.
Okay.
Pentothal isn't even made anymore for the most part in this country. So we use other drugs that are much quicker acting, much quicker to take effect, and much quicker to wear off, and resulting in very limited side effects and the ability to be discharged within an hour or two after surgery.
That's the last one I had, and they decided instead of anesthesia, they would give me propanol, the one that Michael Jackson took.
Correct.
And it was oral, and it was very quick.
Correct.
And I wondered if that was part of their decision.
Well, if it was propofol, then it was intravenously given to
you. Oh.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, propofol can only be given intravenously. They probably gave you a sedative orally.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, okay. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
James, thanks
for
the call.
So you say for 13 procedures, not too much to worry about.
I would not worry about it, no. I mean, the only thing is if you had 13 procedures in 13 days, then I would say, okay, chances are you're going to be have some mental changes, hallucinations for a period of time after that, but there's no real limit to how many you can have.
That's good. I know the form, they say fill out the form for past procedures, and there's not even enough room for them.
Correct.
Okay, James. Thank
you. Okay, thank you. I guess I'll get a pickup truck. That's what Alan should do.
That's what I need. Yep. Okay, let's go to Kim in Brandon, Vermont. Okay, Kim, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest today is, I had an anesthesiologist tell me, I'm a redhead, and he told me that it's commonly known in the anesthesiology community that redheads take a little bit more anesthesia than the rest of the populace, and I was just wondering your opinion on that. And secondly, I have had outpatient surgery, not a lot, thank goodness, but what I have had, my stomach just feels terrible, and I really have a hard time with narcotics. I took my aunt in for a colonoscopy, and they gave her Demerol. I'll be 50 in a few years, and sure, I'll have to probably go through with that procedure. Are there other things out there that I can be given for something like a colonoscopy that would be a little easier on my stomach? She was quite nauseous. And just wondered what your opinions would be on that.
Yes, very interesting question.
Let's go to the redhead.
As far as the red-haired patient goes, I think that's more of an urban myth, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
The other thing they also
maybe he was hitting on her.
Possibility.
I don't know, but I just thought it was interesting.
But they also say that redhead patients tend to bleed more. In all honesty, I haven't seen that. So I think that's more of an urban myth. As far as the second part of the question, you get nausea postoperatively. Is that correct? Is that
how badly. And I can't. I had to have a little dental surgery one time, and I had a very bad reaction to a narcotic that I was given. So I tend to stay clear of anything like that because my stomach just gets so upset.
Yes, that's one of the things when you do see a anesthesiologist or anesthesia provider preoperatively, to tell them that you have this issue of postoperative nausea and vomiting. Because they'll ask you, have you had surgery before? Answer is yes. And any complications with anesthesia? And you would say, well, a lot of post-op nausea and vomiting. So in that situation, we could use a different technique on a surgical procedure. If you're having a lower extremity procedure, you can have it done under a spinal. And if you are having a procedure that requires a general anesthetic, we can also pre-treat you and treat you intraoperatively to try to prevent the nausea and vomiting.
What does that mean, intraoperatively?
During the case, and we can give certain drugs or avoid certain drugs that may cause that. Now, narcotics are notorious for causing nausea and vomiting, but not necessarily because you've had an incident with one of them. Will you have it with the others? I mean, you may have nausea and vomiting with one painkiller, but not with another. So,
okay. Well, good to know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kim.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Yep. Bye.
All right. Bye. Bye.
All right. Let's go to Carolyn in Northampton. Carolyn, you're on.
Hi, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
My sure. pleasure.
I have a question for you. A very good friend of mine a couple of years ago went in for a routine colonoscopy, and he was given anesthesia, and I'm not sure why, but they had an oxygen mask or a mask on his face also. And during this routine colonoscopy, he vomited into the mask and aspirated. And by the time they realized that he was in distress, they ended up keeping him in the hospital for 3 days, I think it was, until they could clear his lungs.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, have you ever heard of this, and how could this happen? Was he not monitored well, or is this something that happens once in a while?
No. Well, that's an unfortunate situation to occur. And yes, this is a concern that we always have is aspiration with the anesthesia. That's why we tell you to be NPO, nothing by mouth, for at least 8 hours before your surgery. And this is one of the worst things that can happen is when you aspirate stomach content that is acidic that goes into your lungs. Because when you're under anesthesia, you don't have your protective airway reflexes. So you end up aspirating this acidic content into your lungs, and you will develop pneumonia postoperatively. Now, this gentleman, he received the mask. Now, whenever you have a sedation given to you, you need to have supplemental oxygen because a patient will tend to hypoventilate. Their breathing will decrease. The volume of breath they take in will decrease. So you always supplement a patient with oxygen whenever they have surgery. So that's not uncommon. As far as the aspiration goes, now, he had a colonoscopy. Now, for a colonoscopy, you are supposed to be NPO, nothing by mouth, for 24 hours. Now, was it possible that he may have had a cup of coffee in the morning? I mean, that's always the concern. Now, if he just aspirated stomach content, which is usually just stomach acid, stomach fluids, yeah, that's an unfortunate event, but it can happen. And that is something that we do monitor for.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. My question is, wouldn't there be someone up near his head to observe this, or do people walk away a little bit during this kind of procedure?
Well, first, was it done under conscious sedation, and was it done just by the gastroenterologist?
Yes.
So there was no anesthesia provider involved then, correct?
I'm not clear on that. I should think there would have been, but I'm really not clear.
Because a lot of these procedures are done under conscious sedation, and are only done with the gastroenterologist in the room with the nurse administering the sedation.
Uh-huh.
So yes, somebody would be at the head observing the patient. If there's an anesthesia provider involved, we are always at the head of the table, and that's something we always look for because there's certain monitoring we do during a anesthetic procedure, and that would, one of them is involved would be watching the patient's respiratory status.
Okay, that clears that up a little bit. The other thing is, the person did show me their instructions, and probably doesn't have them anymore, but they clearly said to keep drinking this fluid in the morning up until, like, I think it was 6 to 8 hours away from the procedure, and I think those instructions really weren't well given. You said 24 hours would be more ideal.
If you're having a colonoscopy, you have to be, you're not supposed to eat anything for 24 hours, and then you're supposed to take a bowel prep, and that's to clean out your entire colon. Now, if you're just having a general anesthetic or a surgical procedure, you only have to be nothing by mouth, NPO, for 8 hours.
Okay.
So a colonoscopy is a different prep because there you need to clean out the colon contents so that the endoscopist can actually have a clear view of the colon.
Yeah, I think what this person maybe was consuming was a little bit of this colon prep again in the morning.
In the morning, right before the surgery, is that before the procedure, fairly, is that correct?
Fairly soon before the surgery.
Yes,
yeah.
And I imagine the instructions were not clear because you're
so,
supposed
to
not have anything. Your stomach really should be empty of any content.
Okay, well, that's been really helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Carolyn. Okay, we're moving right along. Okay, and now we're going to Karen on the Mohawk Trail. Okay, go ahead, Karen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a person who has had chronic pain for many years. From I have systemic lupus. It involves my central nervous system, so I developed atypical trigeminal neuralgia, and I also developed this inflammatory erosive osteoarthritis. So I have significant spinal stenosis. And chronic pain is a very difficult issue both for the patient and the doctor. I mean, no one wants to live with chronic pain, but, you know, we'd like those of us to have it, we would still like to function. I have concerns about what has happened to the perception of legitimate narcotic use. And is there anything on the horizon that can help those of us who do sort of have this chronic pain? Because it can be, I mean, if it's uncontrolled, it's no sort of life.
Okay, Karen, only because there are so many people behind you, I think the question is very clearly put. Go ahead, doctor.
Chronic pain, it's a unfortunate situation that that is debilitating. It prevents you from having your social life, from working, may keep you homebound. And yes, there is this perception of narcotic abuse in patients that have chronic pain. That's an unfortunate thing that is occurring now, because there is patients that require these drugs just to become functional in life. Unfortunately, with systemic lupus and things like that, you have a systemic problem that is not just limited to one extremity. If you had, say, pain in an arm or in a leg, you could use a block to numb the nerves to that spot to give you pain relief. But when you have a systemic disease like this, it's very difficult to treat other than taking PO narcotics or other drugs. Is there something down the road? Drug companies are constantly working on new drugs that have better specific effect to the target and with less side effects. So is there something down the road? This is not really my specialty, chronic pain. There is physicians that actually do advanced training in chronic pain. But down the road, I believe companies will be coming out with more drugs, especially with the with this restriction on narcotics. Something else will be down the line.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead, Karen, real quick.
Thank you very much. Okay. I mean, it's awful because nobody, like as a patient, I don't want to take these things, and I hate the way people look at me or perceive me. But, you know, it's also very different. You know, as you said, the chronic pain is debilitating. And to have any sort of quality of life, it becomes weighing the pros and cons.
Do you see a pain specialist? I mean, that's what I would recommend then. A physician in a specialty in pain management?
I have been through the entire gamut because this has been going on many years. I'm a nutritionist. I practice, exercise, meditation, every single, possible, pain management technique that there is. Unfortunately, I'm sort of intolerant of some of the things that are widely used, like the antiepileptic drugs and things like that. They turn me into a zombie. But I have a great team. I will say I have a great team. And there is a big, I've noticed this, my rheumatologist also has noticed this big push to sort of go to pain clinics where they're very procedure-oriented, like give you an injection or something. But that, it doesn't always get to the root of the problem.
Karen, I am so sorry for your pain. I'm also telling you that we have to go to a small break, and we appreciate your call. I'm sure you've helped a lot of people by your question. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York. Offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com. Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs. Hosting an open house Thursday, February 27th, 6 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany. Serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. And Bow Wow Bathhouse Resort and Daycare, South Deerfield, Massachusetts. For over 7 years, providing 10 hours of daily indoor-outdoor play, professional grooming, and retail shop. TheBowWowBathhouse.com.
And we are back. And let me give you a real fast one that came in over the Internet. I had an epidural during childbirth that kept wearing off on only one side of my body repeatedly. Does that mean epidurals just don't work on me and my body, or could it just be that the anesthesiologist didn't administer it correctly? In other words, if I have another one, would it work next time?
The fact that you had a unilateral block in the past doesn't necessarily mean you'll have it again in the future. That is not an uncommon thing where when an epidural catheter is placed, the catheter goes into the epidural space, but it could deviate to one side or the other. Usually both sides will get the anesthetic drug and you'll have an equal distribution of the agent and you'll be comfortable. When you say it wore out, I imagine I believe you weren't placed on an infusion pump, is that correct? And if there was no infusion pump, then basically they had to bolus you every hour. So that was the situation there. As far as the unilateral block, the way to fix that, and that's something that we've all experienced in our practices. What I would do is I would position the patient to the side that is painful, because it's a liquid and it will grow with gravity to the side, to the dependent side. So that's how I would balance it out. If that didn't work, then I would pull it out and replace it with a new one. So that's really not anything that will prevent you from having an epidural in the future.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. I don't know what happened there. I think somehow we got disconnected. I don't know. Let's go to Robin. Did we do Robin already? I don't know. Robin, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. How are you guys doing? I just have a couple of quick things. Just a quick comment from that woman who was talking about her pain. Mm-hmm. I was addicted to pain medication after several surgeries, and it was the worst thing I've ever experienced in my life. I will never go on pain medication again, but I can say one comment is that since I've been off of it, my pain's better. it's actually better. It's like my own body is taking over and making my pain better.
Interesting.
But maybe not particularly for her, but, you know, for maybe other people. You know, I mean, I was always on prescription pain medication, never illegal drugs or anything. But it's an awful situation. So.
It is. Hey, Robin, you've got to move ahead because there are five people behind you.
With me, I have had, last year I had two intestinal surgeries because I had blockages. I had one surgery, I was out for 2 days, and right back in, they found another one. And I was in the hospital for 10 days.
Wow.
I got out of the hospital, and, well, first of all, in the hospital, I woke up when they were taking tubes out of my throat and stuff. Is that common? Like, I went into a panic. I couldn't breathe.
Right. You had, was this an emergency surgery?
Yes.
Okay. When you come in for an emergency surgery, you are not, we consider you to have a full stomach, especially if you have a bowel obstruction. Because what happens is then the content of your intestines and stomach backs up. So we worry about aspiration,
sure,
vomiting on induction of anesthesia. So in a situation like that, what we do is what's called a rapid sequence induction, where we put you to sleep rather quickly, place a breathing tube into your windpipe to protect your airway. At the end of the case, the anesthesia provider has to be sure that you're wide awake. And in that situation, yes, it was advisable, and I would have done the same thing. I would have waited till you were wide awake and basically, you know, asking with your hands and eyes to remove the tube. But my concern would be to protect your airway so that once the tube is out, if you were to vomit, you could protect your own airway. So, yes,
yeah,
what he did was
scary,
correct.
And they didn't tell me that, so that
correct.
Was scary. But
yeah.
But then now my problem is every time I go to the bathroom, I have almost like a spasm, and it's painful, and it's scary. It's like and all of a sudden I just stop, and I hold my stomach, and I'm like, please stop. I don't have any idea what that is, like what is going on.
Yeah, that sounds like a surgical question to ask the person who did the surgery.
Right. And then where the tube came out is also very painful. There's a big hole in my stomach, and that's also painful.
Mm-hmm.
So I should probably talk to a plastic surgeon or somebody about
correct.
That one.
Correct.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
All righty. Bye.
Good luck. Okay. Then we go to Amy in Taconic. Okay. Amy, you're on.
Hey, I've got a quick question and just a quick comment. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, great. First of all, about those people who said that they were worried about what to take when they had bad relations to medication in relation to having a colonoscopy, I had a great colonoscopy anesthesiologist, and his cocktail that he gave me was morphine, Valium, and ketamine. And I can assure you that as a person who hates drugs and hates hallucinating and hates nausea, it made me feel fantastic. So I really recommend that. And the other question is, when my mom was passing away, she was in hospice. She had some kind of lung medication that was given to her when she was kind of almost passing away, basically, which gave her extremely terrifying hallucinations.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister and I have always wondered what that was and to avoid it, to ask, but we never saw that doctor again. We just wondered if you know of a medication that's given to people when they're in hospice or in critical situations to clear their lungs that may cause really bad mental, those kind of scary LSD trip
Amy, I don't mean to be rude, but I want to keep this moving so we get everybody.
Yeah, what is that?
Okay, sorry to hear about those last things with your mom having those hallucinations. Now, she must have been in a lot of pain, though, to be in hospice. Is that correct?
No, she was the pain medications didn't give her these bad things. It was some kind of lung medication. We always wondered what it was. If you knew what it was.
I'm not quite sure of any lung medications that do that, but there is a drug in anesthesia that is and can be used in patients in hospice that are suffering from terminal cancer that are so debilitated that any more narcotic may make them apneic and make them stop breathing. And it's a drug by the name of ketamine, and that is a drug that is a neuroleptic drug, and it does cause hallucinations. And if you give that without any Versed or Valium or any benzodiazepines, what will happen is a patient will have nightmares, and that is probably the drug that was given. And it, when they say to clean out the lungs, I'm not sure if they what that's meant by that, but I imagine it may have been ketamine if she was having some pain.
Oh, okay. All right. That answers my question.
Thank you. Amy.
Take care. Bye. Bye.
You're welcome.
All right. Let's go to Annie in Vermont. Hey, Annie. Annie?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, your turn.
I'll try to keep this as brief as I can.
Okay.
Thank you for this program. I'm hoping you can help me understand something. I've had a couple of minor procedures before under general anesthesia. One of them went real well. It was TNA as an adult. The other one, I had some problems with the anesthesia. I woke up, but I was totally paralyzed. It scared me to death, and I hyperventilated and ended up being sedated.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, I had a surgical procedure. Had my gallbladder out, and I figured it would be just sort of simple. And it was. I talked over with the surgeon and the anesthesiologist beforehand my experience that I'd had, because it had made me very, you know, it was kind of nervous. And I just wanted them to be aware of it. I didn't really think anything was going to go wrong or anything. But it did. And they lost me, and I don't know exactly what that means. This was an overheard conversation while I was semi-conscious. Three times, had to take me back to the recovery room and bring me back, as it were. And then it happened again when they got me into the holding area. This was outpatient surgery, as gallbladder is these days. And it happened again. And this one, I have no recollection whatsoever of coming and going from the recovery room or any of the things that happened there. They said I was awake, but I don't have any recollection whatsoever until this last one, the third one. I have vague remembers. I had kind of a Jill, what's her last name, Jolty experience, where I was inside there and I could kind of hear my voice and their voices as if they were way far away from me, but no other sensations. I remember asking them to turn the light on and somebody asking me why, and I said, because it's dark and I can't see. I didn't realize that they were actually working on me at the time, and I heard somebody say something, I can't get a pulse, check her clip, and somebody was fishing around for the clip, and I couldn't move my right hand, but the clip was on my left hand, and I took my thumb and pushed the clip back on.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Annie,
what happened. And
okay,
so
is the question what happened?
The question is, I don't understand what could have happened. I haven't gotten the case notes yet. I have no clue.
Okay, mm-hmm. Here we go.
Oh, sorry for any of that unfortunate incident, but now that last case you're talking about, that last surgical procedure you had, was it done under sedation? I mean, because if it's done under just sedation, you can come in and out of consciousness, so you may hear conversations once in a while.
Well, this was afterwards. I have no recollection whatsoever of the surgery or of the period after the surgery.
Did you have general anesthesia for the surgery?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you say you woke up and you felt weak. Is that correct?
No. They tell me that I woke up and they sent me back. They were going to send me back. Afterwards, they told me this because I have no recollection whatsoever until I woke up and they were working on me.
When you say working on you, were they working on you in the operating room?
No. I was back in the holding area getting ready to go home.
Okay.
I'd actually gotten up and gone to the bathroom, then went back and tanked out again.
Okay. Well, you specifically say you had trouble waking up from anesthesia. Now, you could just be genetically predisposed and sensitive to anesthetic drugs. I mean, that's probably
my daughter said that the doctor told her that I apparently was sensitive to something. But the thing is, I don't know what. I don't understand
Correct.
It, and it sort of seems to me like I should know.
Okay, so we got to go real quickly here because we only got a couple of seconds left. So go ahead, Doug.
So, I mean, the purpose of anesthetics are to render you unconscious and sedated and relaxed. So that's not really a side. It's not really a side effect. It's the desire that we want to achieve. You just may be a little more sensitive than most. I mean, as long as the drugs that are given to you aren't causing you harm, these mental status changes you're having are probably, you know, just are what's occurring while the drugs are circulating in your body. I imagine after that procedure, you recovered and you were discharged home. Is that correct?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't have been.
Was everything fine afterwards, though?
No.
What happened?
I wasn't.
Yeah.
I wasn't. And my blood pressure was tanking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you might just be sensitive to drugs in general. You know, so, and as far as what drugs, that's something that really you have to dig into.
I have to get those case notes.
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Annie, thanks for calling. Appreciate
it. Thank you for helping me
You're welcome.
Relax about it.
Okay, thanks, Annie. Okay, we're really running out of time here. Let's go to Jim in Metamore, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on. Can you hear me?
Could you speak to the acute properties, analgesic properties of ketamine, please?
Yes. Ketamine is an old drug that is an excellent pain killer. But the unfortunate thing is it's what's called a neuroleptic, and it basically makes you have hallucinations. And that is one of the reasons why it's not really used anymore. Also, it has the side effect of causing excessive secretions in your mouth. So patients will become very wet in their mouth. Now, as far as ketamine goes, if I had to choose one drug to take onto a deserted island, it would be ketamine. Because with ketamine, you could pretty much do any surgical procedure. Unfortunately, the patients would all have nightmares. But it's an excellent drug if it's used in small amounts and if you give a patient something like Versed, benzodiazepine, like Valium, things like that. So it's not really used much anymore. You can use it in a pinch if you needed it, if the patient is having significant pain while they're having a procedure done under sedation or under a spinal, say the spinal is starting to wear out. A little touch of ketamine will have no side effect really whatsoever. It was in the high doses. When the drug first came out, that's how it was being used, and it was causing all these side effects. And actually, at one time, it was also being used recreationally because of the hallucinations. It was more like LSD, actually.
Hmm.
But it does provide profound analgesia.
Profound analgesia, yes. I remember reading the story about when the bombing occurred out in Colorado, when they had do some surgical procedure on a patient. Really, it had to be done up in the rubble. And they actually used ketamine for the amputation because that was the only drug that you could give that was safe. Because it maintains the blood pressure. It doesn't cause a drop in blood pressure. It gives you analgesia. It prevents you from feeling pain. It prevents you from remembering anything. But it does give you the side effects of the hallucinations.
Okay, Jim, that's got to be it. I'm so sorry, but we're done. All right. The program is essentially done, out of time. Left on the phones were Rich from Whitesboro, we're so sorry, and Vicky from Pittsfield, but we are out of time. Also like to thank our wonderful doctor, Dr. James Anania, for joining us today. Underwriting support for the Vox Pop comes from Topperson, natural creams designed to address the epidemic of addiction to pain medicine by providing pain relief for the 21st century. Topperson.com. Thanks again for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Shartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.